Peggy said that since Papa had already given his blessing, she simply tired of waiting, and it's a good match for both of them. Stephen's to be the 9th patroon of Rensselaerswyck, after all. That much was true. Peggy's new husband stood to inherit a vast ancestral estate, passed down from one of the founders of New Netherlands. I couldn't help worrying over the scandal it might cause for two of Philip Schuyler's daughters to have run off this way, but that wasn't my greatest concern. I put a hand on Angelica's arm. Does she love him? My sister's expression softened. She does. That was enough for me. After all, I would have run off with Alexander if only he'd permitted it. So I had a keen sense of sympathy for Peggy's need to fly to the man she loved. And I welcomed the distraction from worrying about my husband in Congress, facing off against angry veterans. Therefore, in the coming weeks, Angelica and I led a cautious campaign to win over our brooding parents. We exclaimed over how close Peggy would still be to the pastures, for Van Rensselaer Manor stood just a few miles up the Hudson, and we excitedly imagined how soon it would be until Peggy began her own family, which, being 25 already, she was ripe to do. Unexpectedly, Mama was easily won over. In truth, she'd seemed so eager for Peggy to wed, I almost suspected, were it not for the scandal, she would have helped my sister climb out a window to run off with her betrothed, despite how angry she'd once been at Angelica for doing exactly that. And Mama was so swiftly reconciled to it that Papa behaved as if it was all done according to his wishes in the first place. So it was that our parents welcomed Peggy home with open arms, and a reception that reminded me of the one Alexander and I had on our wedding day. This time, however, I'd helped arrange the festivities, working with Mama and Dinah to set the menu, and having Jenny pull together large vases of fresh flowers from the garden to brighten every room. Once again, all of Albany's finest families attended, as well as some of its newer arrivals, like Colonel and Mrs. Burr. And even though I delighted in catching up with Peggy, welcoming Stephen to the family and learning the latest gossip from Theodosia, it all made me miss my husband even more, especially given all the indignities he was being made to suffer as a congressman. Though I did not know it at the time, I'd fled Philadelphia just before our angry unpaid soldiers seized the city arsenals and held my husband, Jemmy Madison, and the rest of Congress at bayonet point in a standoff. After that, Congress became a runaway government, fleeing from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, then Annapolis. All summer long, our Confederation Congress was abused, laughed at, and cursed wherever they went, and I could scarcely imagine what Alexander, who'd done as much as anyone to resolve the disputes before it led to all of this, must have been feeling. It was almost as humiliating for our fledgling country as it was frightening. When Hamilton finally returned to me at my father's house in August, he claimed to be done with it all. Frustrated and demoralized, he said, "If the army's mutiny didn't convince our countrymen to replace the Articles of Confederation with a stronger government, nothing will. So as for you and me and our baby boy, we'll now settle into a purely domestic life." His proclamation suited me just fine, especially when, as the crispness of fall crept into the evening air, Peggy announced after church services that she was expecting her first child. "Oh, we're all to be mothers together," I said, hugging her. Even our little ones joined the celebration when Angelica's son pointed at his Aunt Peggy's belly and said, "Do you have a boy in there? I hope it's a boy." Peggy and I laughed, but Angelica didn't. Mustering a forced smile, she said, "I have exciting news, too. Carter is taking me to Paris." I blinked. "Whatever for?" "My husband is to be a U.S. envoy to the French government," she said, her voice overly cheery. "When do you leave?" Peggy asked, her hand on her still flat stomach. "Before winter." Angelica sighed with a note of regret. Months away. We'll have plenty of time together before I go. But those months passed far too quickly, and when November came, I worried at the damp lace kerchief in my hands as we said our farewells. I was fearful of the dangers of Angelica's ocean journey and pained, as I always was, to be parted from my sisters.
I'm going to miss you both more than words can say.
Poor Betsy, Angelica said. You're taking it almost as hard as Papa.
How else should I take it? You'll both be so far from me.
I'll just be a short boat ride away, Peggy said, blushing pink, as if she were quite pleased to see me weepy at the thought of parting with her. But even though Van Rensselaer Manor wasn't far from the pastures, Alexander and I were shortly destined for New York City, so that boat ride would require nearly a week to accomplish. And I will also be just a boat ride away, albeit a longer boat ride, Angelica said, squeezing my hand.
How long will you be in Europe?
I asked, clutching her hand in return. Not long enough to see everything that I'd like, Angelica sniffed. Which is why you shouldn't envy me. I am to have a taste of the fruit without being given the whole apple. She was teasing to distract me from my sorrow, of course, but the fear that she might believe my sadness resulted from envy was enough for me to force a deep breath and calm myself. My sisters had both married wealthy men who could take them to the ends of the earth, whereas my own husband's circumstances were nowhere as grand. Still, I would never wish to deny my sisters pleasures I couldn't have for myself.
You'll write me every day.
If I were to write every day, I should have even less time to see the sights, Angelica protested, with a blasé expression her sniffles belied. But I'll try to see everything as through my darling Betsy's eyes, for that is the kindest and most enjoyable way to see everything. I smiled through my tears because, like Alexander, my sister had a way of rendering me helpless to her charms. In the meantime, you'll have an adventure setting up housekeeping for my amiable brother-in-law and your darling little one.
I know, I said, and the idea filled me with pleasure and anxiety in equal measure.
We'd be in New York City before year's end, where Alexander intended to set up his law practice and serve as the agent looking after Mr. Carter's business interests while he was away. It was a time for building anew. A family, a home, a country. So it was in New York City that I finally said a tearful farewell to Angelica. With her little brood of children, she climbed aboard a ship to cross the sea, leaving me with a fear for her safety and an ache even greater than when she'd slipped out that back door of Papa's house so many years before. And she was not the only one to go. At long last, the Treaty of Paris had been signed, granting America her independence, and having won it, we were all eager for the British soldiers to leave. Leave they finally did, and with them went almost 30,000 loyalist merchants and citizens, refugees from all over America, who fled that winter to start new lives elsewhere, not to mention thousands of slaves to whom the British had promised freedom. An uncomfortable reminder that our enemy had maintained its promise of liberty to the enslaved much better than had my own country. We were there in the crowds down at the Battery on that cold but glorious evacuation day, as the British boarded their ships and sailed away from New York, making way for Washington's coming procession with the American army to retake the city. I jogged little Philip in my arms, showing him the sails of our enemies receding, so proud that tears sprang to my eyes.
"See what we've done?" I whispered in my son's ear. "We've chased a king back across the sea, darling."
Even the final trick of the departing British could not bring down my jubilation. The British had left their flag flying, tied high to a greased pole, and I laughed that it was a Hollander who gave his wooden cleats to be nailed as rungs to the pole so that it could be claimed and the flag torn down.
The crowd's roar when that Union Jack finally fell to the mud was something I will never forget. A roar that grew to deafening volume when the retreating British fired one final defiant shot, and our bold stars and stripes were raised before the fleet sailed out of sight. Huzzah! 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 The war was over. It was finally over. And I let out a breath that seemed to come from the very core of me, as if I had been holding it for years. Perhaps I had been. But even that moment couldn't compare to the crowd's eruption when our victorious commander-in-chief and his officers marched into the city. We waved flags and cheered and wept. We were Americans now, every one of us. And I think not a single person there had ever felt it more than when General Washington passed by upon his cantering gray-white horse. Amidst the revelry, still I saw the signs of the sacrifice that had been required to bring us to this moment. Mothers who had lost sons, widows who had lost soldier husbands, soldiers who had lost limbs and eyes and years of their lives to the fight. I felt those losses to the core of me as well, because I knew I could have lost my husband. I closed my eyes and offered a prayerful thanksgiving that Alexander stood at my side now, that we were together, and that the danger was behind us. Drums, cannon shots, bells, and song filled the air, and celebratory bonfires burned well into the night. It wasn't until the morning that we were reminded of how much there was still to be done. In my childhood visits to the city, I remembered the bustling wharf, the grand buildings, and the broad, tree-lined avenues. What we found in the wake of the long British occupation was a shelled city of scorched and burned-out edifices now unrecognizable. Livestock roamed freely amidst trash and weeds, fences long gone, and nary a stick in sight. In addition to the looting and the burning, the British had cut down trees and stripped manor houses of wood, burning nearly anything they could find for fuel. And the stench from the mud-choked wharves and excrement in the streets, I couldn't describe it if I tried. "It should all be torn down and replaced," Hamilton said of the hovels that remained. Of course, Alexander saw possibility in all this destruction. He thought much opportunity was to be had in engineers who would make stately homes for the city's new residents. He was already making plans to rebuild the city to its former glory. But for the time being, my husband rented a 3-story house on Wall Street, where the best merchants made their homes, though we could only afford to live at the eastern end, where houses with crumbling mortar, fading paint, and sagging roofs huddled amongst shops and taverns. In fact, our new home was quite near the Queen's Head Tavern, run by a West Indian tavern keeper named Samuel Francis. And it was that very tavern that became the epicenter of our first marital quarrel. We quarreled not because my husband stayed there drinking all hours of the night, as so many wives were apt to complain, but instead because, when the occasion called for it, my husband simply refused to go to the tavern at all. "General Washington is leaving the army," I said, broaching the subject for the third time in as many days. But since the invitation had arrived, Alexander's mood had turned dark. "He's saying farewell to his officers at the tavern, and were you not first and foremost amongst them?" Though I believed right down to the marrow of my bones that my husband had been the best and brightest of Washington's officers, I still expected him to modestly protest that generals like my father, Nathaniel Greene, Lafayette, or Henry Knox had been more instrumental to the victory. But modesty was never one of Alexander's virtues. Instead, he complained, "Congress has not seen fit to recognize me as such. Alexander, I'm not going." Something had changed in him, I thought. Something ate at him, night and day, and I didn't think it was Congress. I wished I understood it. "But Washington is laying down his sword," I said, Such a moment will surely be recorded in the annals of history, Alexander. Shouldn't your name be noted as one of those in attendance? It was then, for the first time, that I learned what it was like to truly stand in opposition to Alexander Hamilton. For what followed was not an indulgent remonstration, nor even a small lecture on all the reasons he should not, would not attend. It was, instead, an onslaught of arguments, stinging in tone as if I were not merely a nagging wife, but also an enemy to be destroyed. Raising every objection I had made or might make as a target, Alexander fired off 10, 12, 20 points in rapid succession, not just vanquishing my opinion, but also snapping at even the fly-wisp ideas that might have still buzzed around its corpse in my brain. When, stunned, I finally opened my mouth to reply, he snapped his paper open. "No more, Betsy." I cannot decide whether my rebelliousness was stoked by the lawyerly tenaciousness with which he harangued me, or the high temper with which he did it, or simply the knowledge that my own mother would never have allowed such an episode to pass in her parlor without exacting a heavy price from my father's peace of mind. The truth was that in refusing to say farewell to Washington, I believed my husband to be doing something enormously foolish that he might one day regret. Sitting there beside him, Mrs. Washington's advice came suddenly to mind. "Sometimes we encourage, sometimes we challenge, and sometimes we manage." And so, instead of staying silent, I challenged him with the one thing I knew to be unutterably true. "George Washington is a great man." My husband's intense eyes fixed on me with dark, stormy disapproval, an edge of contempt and enmity I'd never before imagined could come from the expression of a man as dear to me as life.
"I told you. No more. A certain indulgence must be afforded a Dutchman's daughter in matters of hearth and home, but I'll teach you the absolute necessity of implicit obedience if I must."
It was not the first time my husband warned of discipline. He had, in fact, written similar words in love letters. But those were playful threats, embellished with a courtier's wit. This time, he seemed in earnest. Would he dare raise a hand to me? Though the Bible might have confirmed his right to, my fists balled with a sudden urge to turn my back, summon a carriage, and return with our baby boy to Papa's home in Albany at once. Other fathers would refuse to step into a quarrel between a daughter and a husband, but I didn't doubt even for a moment that my father would shelter me and his grandson, nor that he would take my part in any quarrel. And for Alexander, a breach with my father, one of the foremost men in the state, would dash his ambitions forever. So I felt a gratifying, if discomforting, satisfaction that I held a greater power of happiness and misery over my husband than he held over me. Except for one single solitary thing. I loved him. I loved him so deeply and truly, desperately. And so I let him make this terrible mistake toward Washington and me. That night, I said not another word. Quietly seething, I went to bed. I wouldn't abandon him, as so many others had in his life, but I was no saint. And in the days that followed, I couldn't manage more than polite conversation that felt stilted by the breach. From a newly married Tench Tillman, I later learned that Washington, notorious for his reserve, toasted his officers, invited them to shake his hand, and actually embraced them, weeping. I wasn't there to see it myself, of course, but after it was done, I went alone with Philip to mingle with the crowds at Whitehall Wharf, holding my darling boy so that he wouldn't miss the moment, as the church bells rang and everywhere along the route, people pressed noses to windows and crowded balconies to watch Washington go. At nearly 2 years old, Philip was an uncommonly handsome little boy who laughed with delight and raised his little fists when the soldiers, still cheering, waved their hats as Washington boarded his ferry. I laughed, too, at the joy in the moment, but also wept bittersweet tears. because I feared we might never set eyes upon the grand old man again as the river carried him away, and because, for days, I'd stifled emotion that now crested over at having uncovered another dark layer in my husband that I hadn't known was there before. I soldiered on and tried to distract myself with an upcoming dance assembly that week, a gathering of the city's finest citizens at a grand ball that would effect a reconciliation between the Patriots and any Tories still left in the city. I was eager to slip into my best gown, and the more genteel life that I imagined had preceded the war. More importantly, amiable society so often brought out my husband's playful wit and good humor, and I hoped the occasion might restore the tenderness between us. But then the poorer Patriot citizens objected to the unseemliness of dancing on the graves of their comrades who'd died through the machinations of these very same Tories. The ball was cancelled, and we stayed in instead, and I could barely restrain the sadness I felt at the lost opportunity to restore our happiness. Maybe Alexander sensed it, or perhaps he even shared it. For that night he climbed into bed next to me and wept apologies into my hair for his behavior, confessing a clawing loneliness I'd never fathomed. "But we have so many friends," I assured him, stroking his beloved face. "I couldn't make an accounting of them all, even using all our fingers and toes."
"Your friends," he said hoarsely.
That much was true. Friends from my childhood, friends of my father, friends made only lately in the bustle of his ambitions. But I realized that the friends my husband had called the only family he'd ever known were his brothers at arms, now gone from his life, dispersed like chaff in the wind. John Lawrence was dead. Lafayette had returned to France. McHenry and Tillman to Maryland. And now George Washington to Virginia. I realized the true reason my husband had not said goodbye. Because he couldn't bear to say goodbye. Alexander Hamilton, the orphan, abandoned by those he loved and left to the mercies of this world, had no gift for partings. He'd left Washington's side before Yorktown in what had seemed then to be a fit of pique and pride. But now I wondered if he'd left Washington before Washington could leave him, before he could be abandoned by yet another father and separated again from brothers who he couldn't claim by blood or law, but whom he loved just the same. And so I resolved from that moment on that I would draw closer to us my husband's companions at war. The soldiers here in New York, the officers he'd served with, including Aaron Burr, who'd just moved to the city and seemed so much like Alexander to me that I hoped they might become more than law partners and friends, but maybe even confidants and kindred spirits. Of course, I realize now how naive that hope truly was, for they were as different as night and day. Chapter 15. August 1784, New York City. "How much?" I asked, nauseated by the scent of the fishmonger's wares. As part of my project to reunite my husband's military family, I was hosting a dinner for Lafayette, who'd recently returned to the United States, and the Baron von Steuben, the brilliant Prussian drill master who'd served with my husband, most crucially at Valley Forge. It was said that Prussians loved smoked fish, though apparently my heavily pregnant body did not. So I was grateful to be accompanied to the fish market at Murray's Wharf by Theodosia Burr, with whom I'd spent so many delightful days when our husbands were studying for the bar together. Separated as I was from my sisters, I cherished Theodosia's companionship, for her worldliness and fearlessness reminded me of Angelica, and her brashness and willingness to say anything made me think of Peggy. With our husbands, both lawyers and frequently gone, riding circuit together from court to court, we spent much of our time together. Luckily, the Burrs lived not far from us on Wall Street, so it was easy to always be in one another's houses, our children playing together. And one of the things I appreciated about Theodosia, who was 10 years my senior, was her ability to haggle. "No, that's too much," she said when the merchant barked an amount that was far more for a basket of smoked salmon than anyone ought to pay. The merchant responded by giving a price in another currency altogether. Truthfully, no one seemed to know what sort of money we ought to use. People tried to pay for goods with Spanish doubloons, French guineas, and Prussian carolines, because the continental dollar was so worthless. To make matters worse, each of the states printed their own money, leading to such chaos that no one knew the rate of exchange. We'd finally settled on a price in British shillings, when a man in a knitted cap and filthy homespun breeches spat at Theodosia from where he lurked behind us.
"Tory scum!"
It was, of course, no small thing to be called a Tory in the days just after the war. Though our peace treaty had called for fair treatment, loyalists had been stripped of their rights to serve in various professions and were subjected to the utmost suspicion. Even Theodosia sometimes got caught up in it. Everyone knew she'd previously been married to a British officer, that her sons were ensigns in the king's service, and she'd once counted among her friends Peggy Shippen Arnold, wife of the traitor who'd fled to England within weeks of the British defeat of Yorktown. To some, it didn't seem to matter that Mrs. Burr had supported the Patriot cause and married a veteran in good standing. Whatever the reason, Theodosia gasped as another knave loomed and said,
"Their bodies are in America, but their heads remain in England, and their necks ought to be stretched." "Move on now," the fishmonger barked at the man with a scowl and a wave of his hand. "I'll take whatever money holds value, and I'll not have trouble here." "We'll be back if you keep taking British money," the rascals called as they moved on.
"How dreadful," I said, my hand on Theodosia's arm. "Please don't let such ruffians wound your feelings." "They're scoundrels. It would be bad enough were they driven by a mere thirst for vengeance against the British," Theodosia said as we departed the stall. Rarely did I see her anything but entirely composed. But she shuddered now and released a shaky breath even as she was gracious enough to take the smelly basket of fish from me. She nearly kicked one of the snuffling pigs who were let loose to rove the streets and eat the garbage. "But they'll accuse anyone for a fee, for any slight at all. Neighbor has to fear neighbor turning them in for profit." Fortunately, that night, Lafayette's return and natural ebullience buoyed all of our moods and provided an occasion for celebrating. Seeing the two old friends reunite and witnessing such happiness come over Alexander as I hadn't seen in many months made me forget the unpleasantness at the fish market altogether.
"My dear Hamilton," Lafayette said, grinning. "My dear Marquis," Alexander said, both men laughing and embracing.
Lafayette greeted Baron von Steuben and his aide, then next came to me, where I stood holding Philip's tiny hand. At 2:30, he was up past his bedtime, but we couldn't pass up the opportunity for our son to meet our good friend. Lafayette bowed playfully.
"Madame Hamilton, how motherhood becomes you?"
Nearly 8 months along, the lack of grace I was able to manage with my belly belied the compliment. But I was too happy to see him again to care. "Marquis, welcome to our home."
"Bah!" Lafayette winked and gave a wave of his hand. "Please let us not stand on ceremony of noble titles."
When I nodded and smiled, he crouched down to Philip's eye level.
"Mon Dieu, he is your exact likeness, Hamilton."
My husband beamed while Lafayette addressed our boy. "Bonjour, young man."
"Bonjour, la fille,"
Philip said, in his version of the words Alexander had made him practice. Lafayette laughed and clapped his hands, and everyone joined him.
"Oh, merci. You make me feel the absence from my own little Anastasie, Georges, and Virginie even more acutely," he said of his children,
the last two of whom he'd named for our commander-in-chief and the state where the war had finally been won. Meanwhile, Alexander lifted Philip, gave him a proud hug, and then handed him off to be put to bed by Jenny, who Papa had recently lent to us as a servant. And I escorted everyone into the dining room. Our experience at the fishmonger that day became a subject of conversation at the table I'd carefully laid with frosted wine glasses and festive table mats I'd woven for the occasion. After complimenting me on the meal, the heartiness of which wouldn't have been possible without the shipments of produce my mother sent from Albany every week to ensure the baby's health, Lafayette asked,
"Is it true that New York now has roving commissioners tasked with ferreting out secret enemies?"
The question had been addressed to Alexander, and yet it was a still disturbed Theodosia who replied,
"Oh, yes. And when these so-called enemies are taken to jail, their bails are set so high as to shock the senses and their fines even higher."
"Governor Clinton encourages these levelers," my husband ventured.
After they'd both served as delegates to Congress the previous year, Alexander had taken a loathing to Clinton, who was both a shameless self-seeker as well as an enemy to a strong federal government.
"Like a populist demagogue, he will have anarchy and bloodshed in the streets."
The Baron placed heavy elbows upon the table and spoke in his thick Germanic accent.
"Ja, this is why the Society of the Cincinnati is so vital. In bringing officers of the war to prominence, we can hold together the public order."
Sipping at my wine, I thought that the Baron's sentiments were exactly the kind of talk that had made some of our countrymen suspicious of the new Society of the Cincinnati, though my husband would hear nothing against it. And neither would the fiery Baron, who added,
"Wait until you see the gold eagle badges we're having made for all our members to wear. The extraordinary."
As if for confirmation, he looked to his very attentive aide sitting beside him, who profusely attested to the beauty of the pieces. Amongst our company, only Burr seemed to have reservations.
"Perhaps it is not wise to draw such attention to the Cincinnati just yet, not when Sam Adams is calling it a creation of American nobility, and some state legislatures consider denouncing us as a military aristocracy."
I worried Burr might have the right of it. The controversy had already lost Hamilton a few clients. Indeed, while Alexander could rarely hold any opinion to himself, Burr seemed always reticent to make his known, even to us, his closest friends. I'd hoped the man's more reserved nature might influence my husband's. But sensing the growing tension around the table, I changed the subject. "Dear Lafayette, tell us where your travels will take you."
"Ah, of course. By way of New Jersey, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, I am to go to Virginia, where I will be reunited with our dear Monroe, and finally with our dear General at Mount Vernon. And at some point, I go into the wilds to help America negotiate a treaty with the Iroquois at Fort Stanwix. Perhaps you should come with me, madame, for I recall how valuable you were at my negotiations with that great people so many years ago. And I remember our sweet talk over rum."
Whereupon, to my embarrassment and delight, my husband raised a brow.
"Sweet talk over rum?"
Lafayette laughed.
"I would reassure you it was nothing, my friend, but I see you are jealous, and you deserve to be."
Colonel Burr smiled and winked at me, raising his glass.
"To what Hamilton deserves."
Everyone laughed, including Alexander, who then grinned and raised his glass.
"To Mrs. Hamilton,"
he said, nodding at me, his blue eyes full of affection and amusement.
"And Mrs. Burr, too. These ladies are more than either of us deserve."
The others joined in the toast, and the kind attention warmed my cheeks and heart in equal measure. Returning his glass to the table, Hamilton told Lafayette,
"You must pass on our regards to Monroe and General Washington, with my very sincere esteem, and compliments to Mrs. Washington as well."
At long last, my husband seemed ready to set aside his quarrel with Washington. My heart lightened to hear it, and I believe Lafayette's did too.
We shared across the table a secret conspiratorial smile as Lafayette proposed another toast.
To Washington, savior of his country, benefactor of mankind, the pride of America and the admiration of two hemispheres, and of course, my bosom friend and adoptive father. Ja, gut, to Washington,
the Baron said, standing and lifting his glass as he struck an ostentatious pose. Everyone joined in the toast with enthusiasm, including my husband, proving once more my suspicions that his prior aloofness about Washington's farewell had stemmed from missing the company of his brothers-at-arms.
"Will you have an opportunity to look into the matter of James Armistead while you're in Virginia?"
I asked when we'd all settled again.
And I was a little delighted when Lafayette's eyes flashed with surprise at me for asking.
"Oui? For it is an injustice, like so much about slavery, that cannot stand."
Theodosia frowned. "Who is James Armistead?"
"Only the most vital American spy in the whole Virginia campaign,"
the Marquis replied,
"an enslaved man who posed as a runaway so that the British would trust him. Without him, Cornwallis might well have reinforced Yorktown, and then all would have been lost."
The Marquis recounted how Armistead, while enslaved, volunteered with his master's permission to serve as a soldier in the war and was assigned to Lafayette, who quickly recognized that the man's knowledge of Virginia could make him a valuable spy. Armistead gained the trust of both Arnold and Cornwallis, who allowed him to guide troops through the state, permitted him free access to British Army headquarters, and even bade him to spy on Lafayette.
"I shall never forget the look on Cornwallis's face when he came to our camp to surrender,"
Lafayette continued, holding the whole company rapt with his storytelling.
"And saw Armistead already there? Here Cornwallis thought the man his personal slave, never once suspecting the truth?"
"The problem," Alexander explained, "is that Virginia's law emancipating those slaves who served on their master's behalves applies only to soldiers, not spies."
"So Armistead remains enslaved," I told Theodosia. "It's an outrageous injustice."
"Saul Matthews faces similar difficulty,"
the Baron said, shifting in his seat with agitation as he fed scraps off his plate to the thin pet greyhound he took with him everywhere.
"Many times he supplied us with the intelligence of crucial British troop movements, yet he remains enslaved. These men deserve the applause of their country."
It was a reminder of all the different sorts of people who had taken part in our revolution. Black and white, slaves and free, Indians and immigrants, rich and poor. Women, too.
But my husband's thoughts remained on the injustice of slavery, and he sat forward, exchanging a glance with Burr.
"There's talk of a manumission society forming here in New York. We intend to join."
I couldn't help but wonder what Papa's position would be about a society whose ultimate end was to abolish slavery.
For the institution remained popular within the Dutch areas upstate, but I was proud that my husband planned to be involved.
It might be controversial,
but if my husband's associations must be controversial, then let them be morally right. At length, Theodosia and I excused ourselves to the kitchen to prepare dessert, stewed pears and spiced wine and fresh cream, while Jenny cleared away the dishes.
"Are you sure you're all right?"
I asked Theodosia, who had seemed pale since our encounter in the market, and unusually subdued during dinner. She merely waved off my concern. But later, when the men had gone to the parlor to smoke, Theodosia glanced at Jenny's retreating form and admitted,
"I'm so tired all the time that I don't know how you manage with just one slave."
Sometimes I didn't know either. But the conversation at dinner had left me even more uncomfortable to have full command of Jenny on my own. All our lives, she'd waited on me and my sisters, helping us dress, fixing our hair, tending to our room, even assisting her mother in the kitchen. And though we'd all agreed we couldn't have managed without her, we'd never once, any of us,
given the reality of Jenny's serving us a second thought. It was just how things were. But I remembered those black troops at Morristown, and imagined Armistead and Matthews, enslaved again despite their crucial service, and it all felt wrong. "She's only borrowed," I said, hearing how weak the distinction was even as I uttered the words. "But she's skilled and trustworthy and a great help." And I still didn't know what I'd do without her. Theodosia turned a warm smile to me. "Well, you're an exemplary hostess." As Theodosia was well known for her lavish entertainments in the form of French-style salons, I managed to smile at the compliment despite the discomfiture in my breast. "You're kind to say so. I'd been uneasy that the guest list was unbalanced without unattached ladies to round out the company of the Baron and his aide." At this, Theodosia sputtered with laughter. "Unbalanced indeed. I dare say our Baron and his very handsome aide are not the sort to have any special interest in unattached ladies." "What do you mean?" I asked. "It isn't by happenstance that the Baron is unmarried," Theodosia said, her voice hushing. "Don't you know how he came to join the revolution?" I didn't have the slightest idea. Foreign mercenaries of all sorts had flooded to our shores to join our cause. I assumed the Baron to be one of those, albeit more noble, stout-hearted, and brilliant than almost all the others. Save Lafayette, of course. Now I leaned close to hear more. "He was ejected from the Prussian military for unsavory habits with men," Theodosia confided. "Nearly jailed in France for the same. On account of the fact that the Baron was a brilliant soldier, Ben Franklin smuggled him on a ship to America before he could be arrested as a sodomite." This caused me to drop the half-emptied wine glass I held, spattering the table and my new woven mats with crimson. It seemed apt, since crimson was also the color of my rage, that Theodosia should speak such black-hearted slander against one of my guests. About a hero of the revolution, no less. "That's outrageous," I hissed, thinking less of Theodosia's character than I had before. If she could accuse a good man of the abominable vice of buggery, an accusation that could end in his hanging, I wondered at the sins in her own heart. "People have been executed for such crimes." "And that is outrageous," Theodosia said, bewildering me altogether. By the time our guests said their farewells, I was still stewing about Theodosia's gossip. I was, in truth, so bothered by it that I feared to even confide what she'd said to my husband, lest he suspect that his wife was the sort of creature who dealt in such vile whispers. But that night, before we went upstairs, I asked, "The Baron is a man of high character, is he not?" Hamilton smiled.
"He has his imprudencies, but upon the whole, the Baron is a gentleman of real intelligence, for whom I have a particular esteem. I recall that when he first came to America, he could speak no English, and yet he made himself invaluable. Upon all occasions, he conducted himself like an experienced and brave officer. Did he not impress you at dinner, my dear girl?"
The truth was, the Baron had impressed me. I liked him and his companion. I even liked his dog. And most of all, I liked the salutary effect that he had upon Alexander's mood. So I didn't ask about the Baron's imprudencies, and I promised myself that instead of spreading Theodosia's gossip, I'd instead bask in the success of our party. "You enjoyed yourself tonight," I whispered, leaning back against my husband, where we paused in the doorway to watch our boy sleep in his cradle.
"I enjoyed myself very much." Alexander's hands rested warmly upon my shoulders. "You are a better hostess even than your mother."
I doubted that. I didn't have Mama's perfect understanding of everything that must be done at the dinner table, and the order in which it must be done. But before I could express those thoughts, my husband continued.
"I've found a precious jewel in you."
Alexander wrapped his arms around me, and then his hands drifted down to my rounding belly.
Have I told you how pleased I am that you're giving me another child?
I shall never tire of hearing it, I said. He turned me in his arms so that he could kiss me.
He tasted of wine and exhilaration as he lifted me off my sore feet.
I remembered how happy he'd been at the birth of Philip, and it filled my heart with hope for the future.
But when we finally had our fill of kisses and turned down the bed, the watchman passed our window crying, "Past 10 o'clock, and Cranston the fishmonger is a vile hypocrite and an enemy of freedom."
The war had been won, but it had hardly brought peace. Every day the clamor of the multitudes in the streets grew more menacing. While those streets were christened with new names, Crown Street became Liberty Street, Queen Street became Cedar, King became Pine, in coffee houses, over bowls of grog, at the theater or wherever workmen struggled to clear away the debris and charred remains of war, we heard that no royalists should be suffered to live amongst patriots. What right had men who for 8 years had been destroying property, plundering, burning, killing, and inciting Indian massacres to expect kind and gentle treatment at the hands of a people they'd so deeply injured? The next day, I heard a commotion outside the front window and looked out to see that the usual ebb and flow of carriages and well-dressed people on our wide avenue was now choked by an ill-clad mob, all pointing and laughing at some spectacle at their center. Heedlessly, I rushed onto the front stoop to catch the scent of pine tar, sharp in the air. And there, to my dread, I saw Cranston the fishmonger being forcibly stripped to the waist. I shouted in alarm, but the ruffians ignored me completely as they slathered warm tar over the poor fishmonger's chest and back, and tore open a pillow for the feathers with which to humiliate him. This was followed by placement of a cowbell round his neck and a sign that read, "Look ye Tory crew, see what George your king can do." Fighting back nausea and defying all reason, I took hold of my skirts and waded into the crowd. "Stop this at once!"
"Get back, Mrs. Hamilton,"
one of the men said, daring to lay hands on me as the crack of a whip elicited a shriek of agony from its victim.
"We sons of liberty ask you to remember all the times your husband came so near to death at Washington's side, and you'll know these traitors deserve whatever they get."
Oh, how easily any man could lay claim to the title Son of Liberty now that the war and the danger of being hanged for it had passed. "How do you know he's a traitor?" I asked, pulling away from the grubby, self-styled patriot. "How could anyone know without giving the man a fair trial? Why, the poor tailor Hercules Mulligan was thought to be a traitor until Washington himself revealed that he'd been our spy during the occupation."
"The fishmonger is no Hercules Mulligan," another man called.
Perhaps he was unused to being spoken to in such a fashion by a woman. Because the man stared with such contempt, I thought he might strike me. Fortunately, moments later it was Alexander who had me by both arms, forcing a retreat back to our house. I hadn't expected my husband to return from his law office so early, but oh, how grateful I was to see him, even as he scolded me for being in the street.
"I cannot have you risk yourself," Alexander said, his hand pressed protectively to my belly. "Especially not in your tender condition. What were you thinking?"
"I was thinking that they're going to murder him," I cried, shaking with impotent rage.
"They won't," he assured me. "They took his fish and made him bleed. That will be enough."
I prayed my husband was right, remembering that we'd both seen worse horrors. But the lawlessness unleashed in America since our victory threatened my faith. When a Tory was acquitted by a judge in Charleston, his neighbors simply lay hold of him as soon as he left the courthouse and strung him up. I feared everything we'd struggled for was all coming undone. No sooner had we driven the king from our shores than we seemed intent on proving that we were uncivilized people who couldn't live without a monarch to keep us from behaving as beasts. "What kind of place is this in which to bring up our children?" I asked.
I know, my angel,
Alexander said, holding me.
I, too, fear the revolution's fruits will be blasted by the violence of rash and unprincipled men, motivated by vindictive and selfish passions. So we must set the example and be kind to our neighbors.
I remembered a time when I hadn't set an example, when I'd failed to do the right thing, when I'd not given water to an injured redcoat soldier for fear of what others might think of me. So I resolved to make up for that now, and do just what my husband suggested. That Sunday, I put on my bonnet and marched with great purpose to St. Paul's Chapel. It was all that remained of the burned-down Episcopal Trinity Church, which had been a haven for loyalists. I made a point to seat myself for prayers near the shunned Tory families, and it was there that I first met 16-year-old Elizabeth Courtright, the daughter of a loyalist merchant who'd lost much of his wealth during the war. We exchanged a few pleasantries as I tried to ease the girl's obvious tension, and before long she burst forth, as if the words couldn't be held inside even before a stranger. My father took no part in the war. He stayed because he loves New York. He shouldn't be scorned because he also loved his king. And how can I help him rebuild his fortune if no man will have me for a wife? You're far too pretty to worry on that score, I said reassuringly, certain that her sweet face and dignified manner would make any man overlook the sins of her father. And I invited her to tea at my house the next time I entertained ladies. It was all I could think to do. Fortunately, my husband did much more. Alarmed at the violence, he set out to use the mightiest power he had at his disposal, his pen. And though I didn't know it then, my husband was the best writer of the founding generation. Oh, there are those who will argue that honor goes to a certain Virginian. But he receives enough applause from the rabble without my praise, and I despise him too much to credit his talents. It's enough to know that it was my husband who, in this dark hour, held out so eloquently against the mob in a letter to his fellow citizens, under the pseudonym Phocion, urging them to heed the principles of law and justice. But if Alexander hoped his pen name, cleverly chosen to refer to yet another soldier from antiquity with murky parentage and noble wisdom, would shield his identity? He was wrong. On my daily strolls with my little boy, I felt the glares of passers-by. The baker was no longer content to extend me any sort of credit for bread. The delivery of fresh fruit from my father's farm arrived smashed upon my front stoop, partially wrapped in a paper that featured an anonymous poem aimed unquestionably at my husband, for having become a supposed lackey for the royalists. I burned this poem straight away in the kitchen fire, but that didn't stop Alexander from learning of it, and it wounded him gravely. Many of our friends, most especially Colonel Burr, advised him to let tempers cool and not risk his reputation or our livelihood to defend the Tories. But my dear Hamilton wouldn't listen. Chapter 16. September 25th, 1784, New York City. A girl, I said, gently handing over the little bundle. And at the sight of his daughter, Alexander murmured, "My heart is at once melted into tenderness." "Shall we name her after your mother?" I asked, peering up at him from our bed. He furrowed his brow and rubbed his sleeve over his joyful eyes. "Should we not name her after your mother?" There were already three baby Catherines in our family, for both my mother and Angelica had used the name for their youngest daughters, and Peggy had used it for her first, too. Angelica. There was not a day that passed since my sister left for Europe that I didn't think of her or wish she was nearer to me. I pined for her, treasured every gift she sent, and had even papered the walls of our children's nursery with French sheeting, all covered in pink roses and ivy.
I read Angelica's letters with a selfish avarice, keeping them in a box upon my dressing table, including the one in which she shared the news of the birth of a new baby daughter, Elizabeth. She'd named her for me. That was it. If I couldn't have my sister with me, at least I would have her namesake. What about the name Angelica?
Angelica Hamilton, my husband said, an affectionate smile growing upon his face. We'll call her Anna to distinguish. I cannot think of a more perfect honor for two whom we both hold so dear.
So our daughter was named. A baby with rose-pink cheeks, wide eyes, and a commanding cry. I clutched little Anna to my breast, wishing to give her all the love I couldn't give her namesake across the sea. After I nursed her, I shifted to rise from the bed.
The doctor says you should rest, Alexander said, moving to assist me.
So should you, I replied, longing for his presence at my side. You didn't come to bed last night or the night before. I can't remember the last time you slept.
I am kept at work, he said.
For contrary to his jests about how the law was a study in how to fleece one's neighbor, he'd turned the law into an instrument of justice. In court, my husband, a lion of the revolution against the British, now held himself out as a champion of unfortunate loyalists. And he was something to behold, relentless, persuasive, almost mesmerizing. Not just a lawyer or a politician, but a statesman, determined to change minds and build a united country at any cost.
Having heard him many nights discuss one such case based upon the Trespass Act, I'd come to the courthouse to watch him from the gallery. Every manner of onlooker packed the chamber. Ruffians in homespun, next to the city's finest minds and best families.
Alexander was representing another Tory, and the patriotic fervor in the courtroom against his client worried me more than a little. Finally, my husband rose before the panel of five aldermen, and a hush settled over the restless courtroom. A hush Alexander strung out until the tension was nearly unbearable. And then he unleashed a soaring campaign of words and compelling arguments about why the United States peace treaty, reached with Great Britain, rendered invalid any attempt to persecute the Tories under the Trespass Act. Indeed, the audience leaned forward, as if under the sway of his oratory, as Alexander strode about the chamber, articulating his points one by one, as if building a wall brick by brick. And as it rose, the mood in the crowd changed. Anger turned to questions and suspicion turned to consideration. In the end, Alexander created a whole new policy of judicial review for the country when he argued,
"The legislature of one state cannot repeal the law of the United States."
Alexander's client list expanded after that trial. And no matter how many neighbors cast dark looks my way on the street, or withheld bread, or smashed up my fruit, or wrote evil poems, I couldn't have been prouder of him.
"Mistress," Jenny said from the doorway of the children's room, where I was attempting to bathe a squirming Philip. "There's a gentleman caller."
"I'm afraid Mr. Hamilton is at court," I said.
She bobbed her head. "I told the man as much, but he says he'll wait."
My son squealed and splashed in the copper tub of water, and I wiped my brow with a forearm, sighing with weary exasperation and the hope that he wouldn't awaken his four-month-old sister in her cradle. "Can't the gentleman leave a calling card?"
"He said to tell you he can't afford calling cards, mistress. But he also said to tell you this exactly, that he's brought you a gift of coffee, real coffee, to make up for the swill he once served you in an army tent."
All at once my glum weariness passed, and with a laugh I cheerfully surrendered my little boy, bath, towel, and all, to Jenny. I didn't even take the time to straighten my hair before bounding down the stairs. "Why, James Monroe, is that you in my parlor?" The 6-foot strapping southerner made a strange sight in civilian clothes. Still, how glad I was to see him when he smiled widely over that familiar dimpled chin.
Well, I declare, it's Betsy Schuyler, or Mrs. Hamilton now, I've heard.
It's true, I said gleefully. Nevertheless, I would abandon all pretense of married propriety and give your neck a fond embrace if only I could reach. Dear God!